Welcome everyone to Pharmacy Times. Today we have a panel discussion with Tatiana Gergic, Ryan Shaw, Rebecca Davis, and Rihanna Marusek to discuss cell and gene therapy operationalizing in their institution. So if you would all like to begin by going around and introducing yourselves, that would be fantastic. And then we can get right into the conversation.
Hi, my name is Tatiana Gergic. I am a clinical pharmacist practitioner at UNC Medical Center, and I work with bone marrow transplant, cell therapy, and gene therapy program.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Davis. I'm the clinical program director at UNC for bone marrow transplant, cellular therapy, gene therapy, and malignant hematology.
Hi, I'm Rihanna Marusek. I'm the program manager for genetics and gene therapy here at UNC.
And I am Ryan Shaw. I'm a fellow pharmacist with Tatiana, working in bone marrow transplant, cell and gene therapy at UNC.
Over the past 7 to 10 years, there has been many therapies in both cell and gene therapy space that have been approved, and they pose a unique challenge for the medical centers in terms of operationalizing and coordinating care. These therapies are complex and they require a complex execution across many different departments to ensure alignment both operationally but also clinically and financially. We have several experts on our panel today that can help us get some basics in terms of what steps are required to bring those therapies and make them available. And do it not only efficiently, but in a financially sound way. And also, of course, all of us are very concerned to make sure that it's done in safest ways possible for our patients. So I have Rebecca and Rihanna, who are in charge of operations for cell and gene therapy at UNC, that can help us comment what steps are necessary to kind of get this going.
Okay, thanks. Sure, Tatiana. I'll get started and state that historically, dating back to, I'm going to say 2017, we started with commercial cellular therapy here at UNC. And from that time, we had a medical director for cell therapy that would be the initial point of contact with manufacturers or vendors who had reached out to a clinical provider here at UNC with some type of interest. For treating a disease type that was an option with the cell therapy that was available. And once that medical director contacted the, at the time, program manager, myself, then from there we would contact all of the multidisciplinary groups within UNC, which I would say is probably one of the largest struggles. That's making sure that both the in and outpatient clinical teams, as well as the apheresis and HPC units, were all on the same page and available for the training that would be required to onboard some of these commercial cell therapies. And the initial process for onboarding would take upwards of 18 months when we originally got started. And I will say that probably the largest obstacle or barrier that resulted in so much time being taken was the legal aspect. So, contracting and making sure that the terms of the agreement were acceptable by both UNC and the manufacturer. The legal department here at UNC kind of had to get their situation figured out and who was going to review the parts of the agreement, who were going to be the signatories. And so we stumbled for several years over that, but I would like to say that now things are much improved. To the point that our last commercial onboarding was done in under 8 months. And I will say that, you know, during that 8 month period, we're also making sure that we have breakout meetings with our market access and payer groups, our pharmacy teams, those apheresis and HPC, quality metrics, making sure that if the product needs to be collected and processed before it was sent off, that all of those things were checked off, that a dry run was done with each one of those products and the folks who would be doing that. And from that point, we would move forward with getting the product through our P&T committee, which, you know, we would have pretty much everything figured out and pretty packaged to go forward at that point. But there was no real sense of structure. This was kind of a when they came up, we would do it and we tried to do the same thing as we did the last time, so to speak, but there was no real formal process. So here in the last year, we have started our gene therapy program with all of these new exciting developments. And so I will let Rihanna share a little bit about that operationalizing end now and what we have added to make this a more robust process. Rihanna?
Yeah, absolutely. And so in my role as program manager, one of the biggest things that we've worked on is really centralizing the intake process for these requests, making sure that there's a point of contact for manufacturers, but also for the clinical teams and the interested providers, especially here in oncology and in hematology, but also, as we know, so many areas beyond that are growing in this space. And so making sure that we've gotten in front of these groups and have marketed our resources as a place to come to with interest about these products. I know Rebecca mentioned a little bit in the past how the medical director would be kind of that point of contact, but now we have so many ways that we're keeping eyes on the pulse rate. There are things that get published and articles that come out with products that are going to be available. We have many trials here with manufacturers that we have engagements with, so we're keeping an eye on when they might expect to be approved, in addition to going out to all of our colleagues. And so the formalized structure has really been to involve a lot of the clinical teams, the legal teams, the operational leaders much earlier in these requests. So once we have a product identified and we think from a clinical perspective, we have the patient population that is necessary to treat and we want to be able to offer this product, we start engaging all those other folks on the legal side, the operational side, our financial colleagues, our P&T, our pharmacy and therapeutics colleagues, and then pharmacy, of course, because that infrastructure is so important for where are we going to, when we receive these products, where are they going to go? What kind of freezers do we need? How are we going to get them to the actual patient? And so all of that has started much earlier in these discussions. It's involved a lot more robust intake forms that we use, advisory groups to be able to comment on some logistic things, and then really partnering with our P&T colleagues so that way we can get the product onboarded, and we can operationalize it much sooner in the process as well.
Thank you both
Yeah.
for setting the operational stage up. Looking at so many products that are coming through, Ryan, can you help us kind of figure out what is the best practice for trying to sort out which products may be added to the formulary and what are the steps to kind of make those crucial decisions?
Wow, that's a lot to unpack. I mean, yeah, first of all, I think that going back to what was just said, that the centralizing aspect of our cell and gene therapy program is extremely important. When we think of the products are so diverse in the disease states that they are being approved for now. In 2017, we had one product approved for one indication commercially that we're using for cell therapy. And now, it's roughly, I think, estimated like 10% of the phase three studies are cell and gene therapy related. And we're expecting double digit submissions to the FDA year over year. So we have a lot of products coming. And so how those move through our internal system is extremely important to do appropriately and efficiently, thinking, how can we offer these products to people who need them? So I think UNC has positioned itself well and with several, as we said, growing pains and stumbling blocks throughout the years of trying to get in a place where we can do this safely and effectively. As far as the P&T process, I mean, we do have a request that comes through the P&T side of adding products for review, and we get those monographs done and we talk about those. We do have specific groups that can look at these unique high dollar drugs as well to review their addition and what that cost implication means for the institution. It's very different from our standard drug model when we're talking about drugs that come with a price tag in the millions for these one-time therapies, which is a concern of how we can do that effectively with that upfront cost and that onus on the institution. And so I think there's a lot of concerns that go into these that have specific review from specific people. So I think it's important to kind of set these programs up where you have people with that overall context in mind and where these products fit and what that means for the institution as you are doing those P&T reviews. I think that there are also clinical challenges when we're talking about these products. We have offered a lot of these therapies, and I think have taken the approach of we want patients to have access. But as more and more of these come to market, I think we will start to see more competing indications for different cell and gene therapies, and being cognizant of what the institution is onboarding is important, so you're not kind of drowning in trying to do too much all at once. So I think that it's only going to get more complex over time as more and more of these products are either novel agents for disease states that we didn't even expect to have conversations about, and also as these competing cell and gene therapies come out for current cell and gene therapies that already exist. So I don't know if that exactly answered the question, but those are things that when I'm thinking about operationalizing all of these products that are kind of this window of like why these centralized services and really I think do help make this process a little bit more efficient and more intentional.
That hit it right on the head. I think another big thing with these therapies, it is not a therapy that can be offered in silos. So as we are learning the complexity, we are learning to work with different disciplines. We are expanding in terms of the disease states beyond oncology. Sometimes we are moving in the new spaces within oncology itself. Like we started off with CAR-Ts and hematological space, expanded into the solid tumor space. Now we have gene therapy for sickle cell and beta thalassemia, but there's many products that have been already approved for autoimmune diseases, and there's many more that will be outside of the current space that we are working in. So getting familiar with these new disease states and particularly collaborating with specialists in those particular areas and offering sort of cellular therapy expertise, working hand in hand, creating effective handoffs and having clear algorithms in sort of who is responsible for what will ensure not only patient safety, but also timely access to the therapy and minimize delays.
So, Tatiana, I just wanted to add that one of the exciting things, as you mentioned, that we are expanding into many different disease states and patient populations is that Rihanna has created a roadshow that we have taken now to many different division meetings and with senior leadership avenues just to share the new process for onboarding of cell and gene therapy products here at UNC. And so far, the roadshow has been taken very well. Folks are digesting the information, getting the right intake form, and now they are understanding the process. And so I think that that is hugely going to be a factor in our successful continuation of onboarding products here, because as we continue to expand into nearly every disease state, we have to make sure that folks know the right channel and that we can effectively get products in the door, because we do want to be competitive in the market and offer these as soon as possible with all of the things that are coming up. So I just wanted to add that.
And if it's all right, I'll add as well, during the roadshow, going to all these different groups, it's really enabled us to get ahead of some operational infrastructure challenges that we may not have anticipated otherwise. And so like we know with our pediatric colleagues and a couple of other areas, there's certain things with storing the products, but also just, for example, UNC is in the process of building a new
Children's Hospital, right, in partnership with Duke. And so there are certain things that have to be considered as we prepare as an organization for all the growth that's happening in all these other areas. And those are some things that have come up already at this point, which is really helpful as those groups plan out and get involved more in the space as well.
Yeah, I think that's such a an interesting challenge to face is we have all these different groups now, and you kind of, even once you operationalize like this planning and the background and the onboarding, then you have that clinical side of things of the actual administration and caring for these patients. And I think that's another interesting challenge and avenue that we're still developing over time of especially depending on where that drug is administered and who is caring for the patient at different time frames. And planning that out is also, I think, really important. So kind of the next step down the chain of like, yes, we're planning these things, operationalizing them, getting them through P&T, onboarding them. But there's that clinical aspect that I think we all also plan for of, who is owning care and in what aspects. Obviously, I think that sickle and beta thal gene therapy is a really real-time example of that, of like how they transition through the sickle clinic, but then they still need myeloablative chemotherapy, and the best place to do that is in our bone marrow transplant program, and then transition to those providers, and when do they see referrals, and when do they get brought in for apheresis and things, I think is a unique aspect to that particular type of gene therapy, which obviously not all gene therapy is, but I do think like the flow of patient in the clinical aspect is also really important that we've learned to kind of try and stay ahead of and plan out in a very intentional way.
Yes. So clinical piece, in addition to patient flow and efficient transitions of care, there's a lot more that goes into that in terms of proper staff training from our physicians to pharmacy staff to nursing staff. Our coordinators are essential in making sure that we are staying on track every step of the way. There are financial coordinators that are making sure most of these products require prior approvals or special agreements, depending on the product, that all those pieces are in place. And a lot of them happen not sequentially, but in parallel. So making sure that somebody is overseeing that all pieces are moving in the right direction at the right rate minimizes the risk of things falling through the cracks, but more importantly, minimizes the risk of patient delays. So there is extensive sort of operational support system that goes with this in terms of standard operating procedures, making sure that we are staying on track in terms of prophylaxis and management of not just toxicities from the chemotherapy, but also supportive care that comes from some of the therapy-related toxicities, which we see in both acute and in delay settings, and that everybody is familiar how to recognize and treat those appropriately early on. And now that we have some changes in the REMS in terms of required monitoring post, particularly cellular therapy products, we see our patients moving back to their home oncologist earlier and earlier, and it's even more imperative that we have good transitions of care in terms of what they should monitor, when they need to call us, and how to recognize some of those delayed toxicities sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one thing that UNC has done well with too is kind of writing some of these toxicity management things into policy and guidelines. So that it has a consensus agreed upon, literature supported sort of way, which pharmacy is also obviously like pretty integral in developing and designing these, especially because what to expect and how we manage it has changed so much over time. It's definitely not been static since these were approved. And we've learned that we need to expect different things to come out over time as we're treating these patients in the real world. And we're learning more side effects from, or unique side effects from individual products. So I think it's been a huge learning curve, but also I think being adaptable and being nimble and recognizing the need for guidelines when we need them, and having people who are prompt, and having people getting the right people in the room to make consensus recommendations, has been really, I think, beneficial here at UNC.
We have talked a little bit about operations and also touched upon on clinicals. I think another big thing is patient education and caregiver education and support that is available. Maybe either Rebecca or Rihanna can respectively touch upon what are resources that are available to help not only with education, but also financial support, as many of these patients have to move away from home to be closer to a treatment center, and what's available to support them through that process.
Yeah, I'll kick us off with that. So we have a pretty robust patient education program here. We have our transplant nurse coordinators as well as our social workers meet with each patient before they undergo cell or gene therapy treatment. We give them not only verbal education, but also written literature. Much of that is provided by the manufacturer, but we also have some homegrown information. So we give all of our new patients a binder that has pretty much resources from A to Z concerning lodging, how to navigate around this institution because it's quite large compared to most patients are coming from the community setting and really not used to this big of an academic medical center. So we do give them that new patient booklet on the consult date, and then we have them bring that booklet back whenever they meet with their nurse coordinator and the social worker so that that information can be gone over in real time. All the patient's questions can be answered. We have a really great lodging option here. And so we have the SECU house, which is just a couple of miles down the road from the hospital. And our patients, thankfully, for bone marrow transplant and cell and gene therapy, do have prioritization for the suites in the SECU house. They are aware of all of the requirements that we have for isolation for these patients, especially as they're, just being newly treated. And there's also transportation from the SECU house that can bring patients if they do not have their own transportation. I would say a big piece of what our patients struggle with and what we have to overcome is the caregiving aspect. We really are diligent about making sure patients have caregiver support, and that's, to report any symptoms that the patient doesn't pick up on, make sure the medications are filled and taken appropriately, and really just be that liaison for that patient because this is such an intense treatment. And so we make sure that that caregiver is involved from day one as well. Our social worker does have the caregiver kind of, sign off on the plan that they understand what they're committing to. That's 24-hour day care while they're under the intensive treatment period here. And so all of those things, I think, have helped our program sustain, successful outcomes with our patients. We always, you have the handful that are really hard to educate or get through to get them to understand the intensive treatment that they're getting ready to have and what the implications are if they don't follow the guidelines that we give them. And so, on the same vein, we do have a direct line, which is, I think, very important for our patients. So instead of calling what would be, like a triage hospital operator, we have our own nurse line that patients can call directly to if they have any questions, symptoms, complications that they need to report during business hours. And so a live nurse will answer that call. And I think that that's been hugely successful for us as well to make sure that the patient's getting what they need in real time. Rihanna, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll say real quick, Rebecca, I didn't know if you wanted to brag because the program has been so successful. The award that the BMT clinic just got recently, we were the first. I didn't know if you wanted to touch on that a little bit and brag about that side too. Yes, so our BMT cell therapy clinic did receive the National Pinnacle Award. And so for those who aren't familiar with what that is, they're based on the Press Ganey patient satisfaction scores, and it's a rolling 3-year period that you have to be in the 99th percentile nationally
And so out of thousands and thousands of clinics and academic medical centers across the country, we were the first clinic to be awarded that honor, and the first one here at UNC, the first one that I'm aware of, locally at all. And so that's been a very big deal for our institution. We were recognized at the entity level, and so our team really is prideful about the care that they give our patients, and I think it speaks volumes to itself that that award was won. It's our patients come through, and it feels more like family to them. Our nursing and clinical staff get to know patients, their caregivers, their family members, check in on them. They're here so much. You really do have to build that relationship, and I think building that relationship creates, trust. And so there's a bond that the patient feels safe, then, they're going to be more apt to share any concerns or any fears that they have. And so I think that making sure that we have been at the helm for those patients and in a way that speaks truly to them that we care about them and what the outcome is, not just to say that they were treated here, is pretty incredible.
That's very awesome. I'm sure you can glean from everything Rebecca just said. It really does take a village, and we're very proud of all the efforts here. And in those binders that we give our patients, there's so many of our care team providers who are listed. Of course, our MDs, our APPs, our pharmacists, who are all part of those programs. And then, of course, our coordinators and navigators who are involved and other administrative personnel. I think the only thing I'll add is, as we are in the process of building up the infrastructure on the in vivo gene therapy side and how that is branching outside of the oncology areas, is we're figuring out within those clinical teams, like, what are the resources that they have and how can we as a program help support that? And we didn't really touch on the background work that our navigators and coordinators are also doing as well, which is, helping with prior authorizations and other things with the payers. We know that we're going to be partnering very closely with pharmacy and our medication assistance program to help that in the other areas. But there are so many other things that we're having conversations about and how we can support and make sure the patient education piece is not overlooked. Connecting folks to the SECU house where it makes sense, our central navigation teams, all those conversations are happening as we're building up that side.
And I think speaking to the backside of Tatiana's question about financial obstacles and barriers as well. So we as an institution function that will onboard a cell and gene therapy product regardless of what reimbursement is going to look like at the patient level. And so once we have onboarded a product and have identified patients that are going to be clinically treated, that's really when the financial process gets started. And we do have embedded transplant financial coordinators who are also dedicated to the cell therapy space. And so getting that prior authorization is obviously first and key. But past that, we do have very close working relationships with our managed care team here. And so that's where you'll have your carved out contracting, single case agreements for patients, and the financial vetting that the patients go through, just to ensure that not only they don't incur a lot of financial toxicity, but as well as the institution. It's a very in-depth process, and we really have to make sure that everyone is on the same page and aware with exactly what the out-of-pocket costs are going to be, what is the payer going to cover as far as standard of care, and of course, then the product itself, we spoke to, it can be in the millions. Typically gets processed a little bit differently and invoiced separately than what the actual care is going to be. But so making sure that all of those pieces come together and that the patient is adequately educated and prepared for what is going to be on the back end of all of this treatment financially is very important, and it truly does take a village to make sure that everybody is on the same page.
Ryan, did you have anything to add in terms of mitigating financial toxicity for our patients?
I had a few thoughts. This is a little bit off track, but when Rebecca had been talking about kind of the support that our patients get in the more traditional cell therapy and the ex vivo gene therapies, the other thing that I think that we have done a pretty good job of is finding ways for when those people do have emergent things, of being able to triage them appropriately and effectively. So getting ways for our emergency department to, not have somebody who's immunocompromised sitting around in the middle of flu season with other people in the emergency room is important. And I think we have a mechanism in place that fast tracks those folks through the ED. We also have a direct admit process for a lot of our cell and gene therapy folks when their complications do come up, so that they can get into the unit faster and get the care that they need a little bit faster. So I think those are other clinical sides of things that go with delivering the best patient care we can for these people in a fairly high risk population. I do think that we have other pharmacy targeted resources that we do, not specifically for the cell and gene therapies themselves, but we do have an entire manufacturer assistance program that has technicians that help with getting PAs approved and appeals written for some of the supportive meds that come with these therapies, to make that process a little bit more efficient and less financially toxic for the patients who are coming through. And pharmacy assistance programs. So when people are on or underinsured, of ways that we can like bridge the gap until we can work with financial folks and social workers to get them the whatever insurance they need. So I think on the pharmacy specific end of things, there's also a lot of resources that we can put towards kind of effectively delivering care around this patient population.
Wonderful. And just to make sure that we have a well-rounded conversation, I do want us to touch a little bit on the technology that's required to and how we can kind of use that to leverage safest patient care and ensure smooth transitions of care in terms of building order sets and treatment plans within the EHR. I know for our cell therapy patients, we have specific banners that pop up to alert folks, including in the ED or anytime anybody gets into the patient chart that this is a cell therapy patient and there are certain medications that should not be given or should only be given under guidance of the cellular therapy team. So leveraging some of the technology advances in helping us ensure that patients are receiving best care through each transition of care as they navigate our health system has been really helpful. The other piece that I wanted us to touch a little bit on is the quality, how we are tracking our outcomes, how we're learning from that to kind of fine-tune and optimize process as we have sort of grown this program starting in 2016 with just few homegrown research clinical trials in CAR T space through many different now commercially available cellular therapies and a growing number of gene therapy as well. A lot of payers are moving to outcome-based reimbursement. So how are we staying abreast of those changes and making sure that we are optimizing care and also getting the best a possible return on investment?
Well, I'll speak briefly to some of our outcome information and our reporting metrics. So we also have a very robust data management program that's built in for BMT and cell and gene therapy. And so we kind of started from the ground up. As Tatiana mentioned, back in 2016, I think we had three data managers. So all of the patient data and their outcomes get reported to the CIBMTR. And we, of course, also follow and report on those metrics every month at our internal quality management meeting. And so we invite all of our interdisciplinary teams and share that information. There's also, there's back and forth lesson learned from different areas and all our collaborations. I can say now that we have grown and we actually have five data managers, and then our gene therapy also has an additional data analyst. And so as we continue to expand indications, we do kind of mirror that with our resources and staffing. And so our data management team, at least in my opinion, has been integral in making sure that our outcomes are not only reported but are accurate. And so I'm very proud of the work that our team continues to do. And I think it goes without saying, our patients are monitored for the lifetime with BMT. And with cell and gene therapy, this is a newer space for how long do we need to monitor them, report their outcomes, how much do we need to report? And I think those things are still, kind of at the cellular level being determined, and we kind of are learning more each year and with each product that we onboard. But it's definitely time and labor intensive to make sure that these folks are reporting the right information so that we can then learn from each patient experience and kind of improve on the next journey.
Yeah, and that,
Wonderful.
as a total and a complete total aside, for any of the pharmacy folks who are listening who like are interested in pharmacy-based research, be friends with your data managers. They're extremely helpful.
Wonderful. And as we are sort of ending or nearing the end of our allotted time, I do want us to touch a little bit about building the network, planning for scaling up as the products and patient numbers increase, and also sort of building our network with referrals in terms of outreach to centers, because I do think there is some disparity in terms of patient access, especially we know that patients who are further away from the treatment centers don't necessarily always have access to some of these treatments, which have become increasingly recommended in second line therapy. So, what can we do in terms of not just making these therapies available in our center, but how we capture as many patients as would benefit from these therapies and collaborate with our referral centers in order to make it happen in a timely manner?
I'll start. So, in terms of building our infrastructure and making sure that our resources are matching what our growth projection and plans are, the UNC Health System has been very supportive, I'll say, of our cell and gene therapy program. It has been highly prioritized and focused as a spotlighted treatment area over the last several years. And we have built internal pro formas, submitted those to senior leadership. That has actually been not only approved, and we have met and are exceeding that expected growth. And so the initial projection was something along the lines of like 20% growth. And I can say that we were closer to 30% the last fiscal year. And so with those projections, with the volume increases, expenses increase, but so will revenue. And so in that effort, we have been granted some additional positions within the program. And I think that it speaks volumes, just to say that the investment the institution does focus on this program with. We have been fortunate enough to add a nurse coordinator, we'll add a financial coordinator, a data manager, and with gene therapy, we've gotten the program manager, we've gotten a data analyst, we've gotten a patient navigator. And so I think there's a real need for the resourcing to be present so that we can continue being successful in this space. And I'm very excited that the hospital has made the investment for us, and we continue to outshine the expectations. So that's my thoughts.
Thank you, Rebecca. Any additional thoughts in this space?
I mean, I do think that this is a big challenge is, the outreach into communities and having patient access, because a lot of these therapies require you to be a certified center. So that's not going to be every institution across North Carolina or in the Southeast. And so there will have to be referrals coming in from community providers into UNC. And I think UNC does a lot of outreach, and UNC obviously has a big footprint across the state. But I do think, getting education and resources out into the community of when patients should be referred and where they're going to be referred to is important for any institution that has a cell and gene therapy program. So, appropriate planning and partnership with our colleagues is huge and is just going to be more important over time.
Agreed. And as we wrap up, would like to ask each of you or each of us to just kind of give few lessons learned that folks embarking on this journey would find helpful and learn from. So I'm not sure if you guys want me to start or if somebody else wants to start.
Sure, why don't you start?
All right. In my experience, the first product within specific category has usually been the most challenging because you're sort of starting from scratch and trying to figure out all the logistics, financial pieces, all the clinical stuff, all the flow through the system. But once you have that first one under the belt and you have staff trained, a lot of these products have similar type of side effects in terms of CRS and ICANS, specifically for our CAR T products. Stuff becomes more familiar and it's not as difficult to bring subsequent products on board just because we are familiar with at least some basic steps. And I'm not saying that every product is exactly the same. They have their individual nuances, but the general process of flow of patients, referrals, finances, contracting follows the similar process. So don't be intimidated by that first lift. That is usually the hugest lift. Use your resources that are available nationally. Get in touch with folks who have been doing it and kind of use some of the lessons learned from their operations to help you get successfully on this journey.
And I'll follow up. I think one of the biggest takeaways that I continue to have to learn and remember and carry with me every day is that it does truly take a village. So multidisciplinary support is key, and it's actually essential to any institution's success with cell and gene therapy operationalizing. Sorry. I think that making sure you have connected relationships with outside departments, those departments that you're going to need for apheresis, HPC, your inpatient units, just making sure that everybody understands the time sensitivity that's involved with each one of these treatments, making sure that all ends are tied up, that everybody has completed all of the qualifications that they need to do. And of course, any updates that come around, you have to make sure that you stay in contact with these people and make sure that the connections are kept up. And so I think just making sure that everybody understands the sensitivity that's involved around these products is very important.
I guess I'll add on, especially with everything that's coming down the pike, that you don't want to be in a situation where therapy development is outpacing the infrastructure that you have at your institution to be prepared or at least aware and to meet that when the time comes for your patients and for your clinical teams who really want these products and to be able to offer them. I'll say for us, I think finding where the expertise is, we know that, as Tatiana's mentioned so many times, we've been doing this for 10 years now over in oncology and hematology areas. And so being able to identify that expertise and being willing to partner with the other areas and making those bridges and building so that information can be shared collaboratively across these other areas really does better prepare us to have a more centralized approach to how we want to onboard these products and offer them to our patients as more and more things come down the pike. And I think that that's true both here at our academic medical center when you're thinking about partnering on the commercial and the clinical trial side, but then also to many of our community providers who are interested in this and want to be able to find us. So I think being able to have those connections and knowing where the expertise is and being willing to bridge those gaps is really important.
I will just echo all of that. I don't know how much I have to add on all of those, but since this is a pharmacy-based podcast, We have been very lucky at UNC that pharmacy's been involved from the get-go. I don't know that's necessarily true of everywhere, and but think it, I want to emphasize the importance of having pharmacy and pharmacists involved throughout multiple steps in this process, kind of throughout, because we're involved in the drug purchasing, we are involved in the clinical side, we are talking on the P&T committees, and so I think having pharmacists in particular are very well positioned to help with this entire process. So making sure that we stay involved and can be nimble throughout these processes is really important. So that's the pharmacist pitch to all of this too.
Thank you, Ryan, and thank you to all of our wonderful expert panelists today. And with that, we will wrap up for now.